always do.
Great. Okay, so today is March 1st, 2017. This is an interview with Gene Hendricks. These interviews are being done at the Academic Staff Institute here at UW-Madison, so these interviews are being held at Union South. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Gene, to help us with sound quality, could you first say your name and spell your last name?
Gene Hendricks, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S.
Great. So I'm going to get this just a little closer to you.
Okay.
And that just means I'm going to have to project a little bit. So I'm not yelling at you. I'm just sure that my questions get heard.
Okay. I could scoot around a little bit.
No, I think we'll be all right. Okay. So, Gene, the first question, and I gave you the list of questions in advance, is a two-part question. So we're just going to start with the first part. Okay. What brought you to UW-Madison?
Okay. Well, first, my family decided to relocate to Wisconsin from Indiana in 1979. And a year later, I was encouraged by my then coworkers where I was working to take the state test. And since I had been doing payroll at the other place, I decided to, there was a payroll benefits exam that came up, and I took it, and I was hired here in engineering at UW-Madison, and that's where I've been ever since.
So was this a university-specific test, or was this a state test?
It was a state test, but the opening, then you responded to specific openings that were, all the agencies used the test, and it so happened that there was a need, and so engineering used it. I was among the top scorers, so.
And if you don't mind me asking, why did the family relocate from Indiana?
Well, at the time I was married, and my then husband was working for, we were living in his hometown, and he was working for his dad, and that wasn't going so well. And we decided we needed to break away from that, and we took a whole summer, we lived in a pop-up camper and went all the way out west to decide where do we want to relocate, and we stopped through Madison kind of as an afterthought on the way back, and we saw the terrace, and there were creative writing faculty members. My husband was interested in creative writing, and there were faculty members that he was interested in studying with. So we saw, oh, it's not too far. It's far enough away, but it's not, a ginormous leap. So here we came.
Great. Thank you. And then the second part of that question, in your case, what factors led to your work interest?
Okay. Well, it's kind of evolved. I've never been one of those people that's had some passion. You hear people who, when they were 10 years old, they knew they wanted to be X, and nope, that never was me. And, I was already into payroll. And at the time, engineering did not have a dedicated HR position. So I kind of evolved beyond payroll into HR areas and became the HR person. And then when we got bigger still, I ended up, we hired more, and I ended up supervising that office for a while. So kind of, I had a psychology degree and I had a couple years of social work experience, so they thought that was a good way to go. Good path to take for both.
Okay. So, Gene, I know you've been here for you've recently retired, and we'll get to that. But you were here for a fair number of years. So this probably evolved if somebody asked you this question at various times. But the next question is, when asked, how did you describe what you did?
Okay, I assumed you meant then. Present tense. Now, that's a short answer. Now. Right. I guess in general, I would say that I provided consulting, HR, professional consulting, and oversight to a variety of different people, advising and managers and employees, and also sometimes collaborating with my colleagues across campus to assist them in dealing with HR issues and processes. And that occurred, that communication occurred email and or phone and or in person, depending on what would work best. And I developed a network of campus experts that I could call upon to help me with a particular situation. And I was grateful for that and used it quite frequently. I also did a lot of editing of documents that people thought I was pretty good at taking a draft and fine-tuning it and making the communication clearer and maybe strengthening it. So I did a lot of that for communications that were sent out by people, all the way from the deans, faculty, staff, employees, and also, which we'll get to when I was on the PPPC, I helped, you know, with that editing there. Also, I always was interested in more training. I've never been someone who thought she knew it all. I mean, no matter how many years I've been here, I do not know it all. And there's some things that change. And I looked for trainings that would sharpen my skills, update my skills, and took those. And I had a lot of really good training on this campus.
Yeah, I was just actually, one of my follow-up questions as you were speaking was going to be about training. So it sounds like not necessarily academic training that led to a degree, but
no,
training.
It was jobs. Yeah, it was more job-related training on, you know, dealing with difficult people and communication skills and interactions and sometimes training on the latest software products that we used and or training on new laws and regulations that we had to administer, things like that.
Okay. So, I have what task, but I assume you understand that was actually what tasks comprise a typical day.
Yeah, and so, it could be a mix of any of those. You know, each day was a little bit different depending on what came up and what was already on tap. Also, meetings. I left that out. I attend a lot of meetings of campus groups and, you know, governance groups and college groups and, you know, similar.
Mm-hmm. Did you I'll wait because there's something I want to talk about, but it's later on, so
okay.
I think that'll work for that.
Okay.
So I guess my follow-up to that would be, was a typical day then primarily in your office, or would it be elsewhere?
It depends on the schedule. If I had stuff scheduled out of the office, then that day would be primarily doing that stuff. But if it was a day where there was mostly consulting and in-house editing and all that kind of stuff, then it would be primarily in my office area. Sometimes in my office, but I would certainly be willing to go to other offices if it would be more helpful to whoever I was working with, and I did a lot of that too. So
where was your office, or where were your offices?
My office. Through the
years?
Oh my gosh. Okay. When I started work, my office was in Engineering Research Building, fourth floor. At that time, there were two separate dean's offices for engineering, one with the instructional mission and funding, and the other with the research mission and funding. And I was hired into the research half, which was in Engineering Research Building. The other half was in Engineering Hall at the time. And I was in a big room that had a bunch of desks in it, you know, different staff members, not even any partitions, just the bullpen, I guess you could say, of the support staff who did payroll and accounting and purchasing and some other functions. So that's where it started. And then when Bollinger became dean, I've been through, I think, four deans in my career. When Bollinger became dean, he decided that was stupid, and he integrated the administrative functions into one area, which was in Mechanical Engineering Building. So then my office was moved to a private office on the second floor of Mechanical Engineering Building. When you went up the stairs, at the time, it was the first door to your left. So, and the building is remodeled now, so you probably wouldn't be able to tell if you went up there. I don't know. And it was kind of it was very accessible. There were students, you know, there was traffic in the hallways all the time because there were classes around the area too. And actually I had my wallet stolen twice out of my office when I was only out of it for a couple minutes because, you know, I didn't lock my door and et cetera. So yeah, it was very, and then and I don't remember when this was, Engineering Hall was remodeled. And at the end of the remodeling, then all the administrative offices were moved into, on the second floor, the new part of Engineering Hall. So that's where I ended up.
So, three spaces.
Well, technically, I guess it's four, because when we got over to that new part of Engineering Hall, between the time that I started there and the time that I left, I moved down a little ways to a different specific office. Okay. So a little internal remodeling and restructuring was what brought that about.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah.
And we talked a little bit about the cough, so you know, whenever
sipping so far.
Yep. So there's one more question I want to ask before we move. Well, actually, no, I'm going to wait for that one too. So the next question on the list is technology. I mean, you were here. You've been here for a long enough time to see some changes in technology. So
when I started and I was doing payroll, everything was manual. We had these big IBM computer printout sheets with people's name printed on and multiply, and we would go through those to do and card them off to Bascom at the time, and that was the payroll. That was how we did payroll. So, you know, there's been a lot of technology that has come on board since that point in time. We had, for a while, we had Wang typewriter thingies, and then eventually computers, and increasingly more user-friendly ones that meant that I would increasingly, my duties were less routine and manual and more knowledge and wisdom based. And I had to learn and understand whatever technology we were currently using to capture the tasks that I did. We've been through several appointment and payroll systems since I've started, and each of those was, you know, implemented with the usual glitches in the beginning, and then just when we got used to it, they decided to do something else, so off we'd go. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the main. The other thing is the amount and the complexity of the information that I had to absorb and deal with increased with that. You know, down, less routine manual, more brain work. Mm-hmm. And also, it also made it easier with email and with more than one caller, things made it easier to collaborate with people in other areas, you know, like across campus, et cetera, which was good because then we could kind of work together to solve a problem or deal with an issue.
So I wonder if you have a for example for that. I love how you said that it moved from manual to more of a knowledge wisdom based. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a for example of what you mean by that.
Part of my duties were to administer whatever laws, rules, policies, etc. Were in place. And that's where it helped to understand the current, but it also helped to understand the history behind them and the letter of the law, so to speak, versus the spirit of the law, and to know when I could kind of work around things and when I couldn't. So I guess didn't think well. Each new HR or payroll computer system, there were boundaries, and it didn't always align with our policies. And so we kind of had to figure out well, if I do this, what I really need to accomplish is X, but the program won't let me. So, you know, either I had to work around it or know that I could contact somebody at the campus level with more authorizations than I had and have them work around for me. If we both had an understanding of this is okay because this is the end we want to accomplish. Now that's kind of, it's not very specific, but.
Yeah, but that's still, that's a, I think that will give people a general understanding of what you meant by that.
Yeah. It's hard at this much after my after I retired. It's kind of hard to remember some of those.
Right. you mentioned email too, but I wonder if maybe you'd have a for example of how email made something you did better or more efficient than just having the phone.
All right. For an example, I had, let's say, there was an issue and there was a communication that needed to be given to either a supervisor or a staff member about some problem. And usually maybe it could be something that they did that was inappropriate, or what they were considering doing and it was not appropriate, or there's a better way, or, you know. And sometimes these, because of the subject matter, if it involves some law or something like that, that it would be a situation where it would, the draft would need to be reviewed by what usually me, maybe OHR, maybe legal, maybe affirmative action office or diversity office. And I could draft something and email it out to all those people and they could all be looking at it at the same time and give me feedback. So I would then get, whereas, you know, otherwise it would be much, I would have to get paper copies to everybody and they would, it would have, that would have to be handled very carefully, and, you know, it, they, it would take longer for them to get back to me, you know, because, you know, the situation's the same for them. You know, the technology means they can get to more things in a shorter period of time. So, you know, that's an example.
Okay. I think it's my last question about technology. Again, you've had enough lived experience on this campus that I'm wondering if there are some times that the technology was more burdensome. Like, is there a time where you wish things might have been how they used to be?
I don't think I ever felt, ever wished that it, for the old days, but sometimes I wished that the technology was more, it was better. There was a lot of room for improvement in it. But I would not want to go back to the old days when we did it all handwriting and carbon copies and, you know, all that stuff. No. Other people did not always feel that way. Many of the employees, the staff, and the supervisors I work with have worked with over the years, when we've gotten something new like that, they have, there's been some resistance because it's out of the comfort zone. You know, you learn your duties, you know how to do them, you're comfortable, you have a sense of that, you a confidence, and anything new jeopardized that. And I, it was important that I understand that and communicate, help people along with that understanding that this is not easy for them.
So, not to put words in your mouth, but I will, and feel free to. But it sounds like you know, you experienced a lot of change, but for the most part, you were okay, or at least understanding that it was going to happen.
Yes, and if I understood why the change was happening and what the end game was, what would be better after that change was fully implemented, that helped a lot.
Okay. Thank you. So the next question on the list, and this comes from the award that you got, and we'll talk more about the award towards the end here if we get to it. But in that nomination, or at least the blurb that they wrote about your award, that people said that you excelled at working through difficult questions or problems.
Okay.
So my question is, why do you think you did that, or why do you think they thought you
okay,
did that?
Okay, and that's probably a better way. I'm not someone who's a self-promoter, so I'm just kind of like, And I have to say that it was very gratifying to me and to read the materials that were submitted for the award. You know, I was gratified to that. That's the way people viewed me, and I'm glad that I've added value over the years. So having said that, I guess because I always tried to listen and understand the point of view of whoever I was working with, and I mean, kind of alluded to that in my previous answer about technological change, helping people adapt to technology. And I wanted to, my goal was to work with people to come up with the best course of action for whatever it was, you know, not that it's a collaborative more than, you know, I never wanted to be an enforcer. It was part of my job to administer whatever laws and rules that pertain to HR, but I never wanted to approach that as an enforcer, but as a facilitator, you know, to find, you know, the best solution. And sometimes there wasn't really an optimal solution, but, or, you know, there wasn't something that would make everyone totally happy. But, you know, what's the best we can come up with? And if we're both involved in the process, then, you know, it usually ends up a lot better, that people have a little bit of ownership into what happens at the end. And I was very, like I said, I don't know it all. No matter how many, I don't care how many years, I'm never going to know it all. And I always was very free to consult with the campus experts in various areas. To help me to make sure that we came up with the best suggestions to offer to the employee or supervisor, whoever. And with some of the rules, sometimes the supervisor would come in and they would think they know, I want to do X specifically. Well, for what a reason that you can't do X. But where do you really want to go? What do you really want to end up with? Is there another pathway that we can take that will get you to the same place or close to it? job classifications is a good example. You know, everybody wanted academy staff. Nobody wanted classified/university staff because there's a perception of a value differential, which I always fought and spoke against whenever possible, because I don't like those attitudes. So I tried, okay, you know, you want a professional, there are university staff who are the positions which are professional. This one more aligns with what you want them to actually do. Let's go this route. Sometimes it was a matter of the perception, and it wasn't unreasonable, of ease of hiring process. It's gotten better, but the classified hiring process before we split off was much more burdensome and a lot more hoops to jump through, and a lot of the steps that you had to do I don't think added a whole lot of value. So people wanted academic staff because they didn't want to do all that. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to accept resumes, review them, rate them, bring in, interview the best, hire the best. And I think current processes all around are more like that, which I'm glad of. But, you know, some of those reasons, and I understand those reasons, but if you can't, and then at the end of the day, you have to get someone who, to whom you've communicated what their actual job duties will be, and not, you know, puffed it up to get it into a certain category and then have them come and they're not doing those things that they thought they'd be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's happy in those situations.
Right.
So I've tried to be fair to everyone, to come up with courses of action that are as fair as possible to everyone that's involved. And I tried to communicate very carefully, because to me, how you communicate is just as important as what you communicate. And I've tried to help people to separate the facts of the situation from their interpretations of the facts. Because people can conflate those at times. And I can too. And that's one of the things I always sought out more training in, how to help people make those distinctions. Because some of these skills, it's not like you get them and you have them forever. You have to remind yourself, refresh.
So it sounds like it was, for you, a benefit to be on this campus because you would have those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But then also you took advantage of those opportunities.
Yes. Campus has wonderful training, especially since Don Shute came on board and the Office of HR, Human Resource Development, initially it was called on these days, who knows. But, you know, he established really excellent training programs. The Diversity Office has good training programs. Employee Assistance has good training programs. And all of those offices, I took advantage of the training that they offered.
Just writing something down.
Okay.
So I want to sort of I want to follow up on that because there was one thing I wanted to ask from your initial. So when you got this job initially, mm-hmm. was there any super? So in the 70s, was there any supervisory aspect to it
for me?
For you?
No. Nope.
Okay. So as the years went along, you became a supervisor.
Yes.
So how did you learn to be a supervisor?
I think the training in that area was not really developed very well when I first became a supervisor. But as more came on board, I tried to, again, take advantage of some of those opportunities. But that is where, you know, looking back, it would have been nice if I had better training for that, because I had never been a supervisor ever in my entire work life.
Somebody just tried to open the door.
Oh, okay. I figured.
Yeah, but we're only at 10:30.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But we probably will try to, since I'm going to put this on the record, mm-hmm. the fact that you're willing to
yes,
be interviewed again.
Yeah.
So,
I said, I'd rather be thorough.
Right. So I don't know if I want to delve into the academic staff personnel policy thing right now, just because I know we could go deep.
Oh, okay.
Maybe what we'll do to conclude this one, since I found out about you because you won one of the academic staff awards.
Yep.
So why don't we end with that?
To that? Okay.
And then we'll do a follow-up interview for the other stuff.
Okay.
So the specific question is sort of a vague one, but it's really if you could just tell the story behind the academic staff award.
Well, you know, the award had been established a couple years earlier by Ann Wallace, so it was a relatively new award. And as my retirement was approaching, Bruno Browning contacted me, and he said he was planning on submitting a nomination on my behalf, and he needed a resume. Now, this is something you can't surprise people with, because the nominee needs to submit a resume as part of the package, so they kind of had to. I was very touched that Bruno would think highly enough of me to decide that he wanted to make the time and effort to initiate and coordinate my nomination. That resume I found very difficult to write, because usually when you're writing a resume, you're looking for a new job. And so, but my resume was a little bit different for a very different purpose. So I kind of, you know, worked on that for a while. Luckily, by the time I had to do that, I was retired. So I had more time. I thought, oh, great. You know, that's nice. I was honored to be nominated. And then when I found out I got it, I'm like, oh my God. Can't believe this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were other very worthy nominees for this, and I just was honored again to be to win the award. And then when I read the support documentation that went up, the Bruno's cover and the other letters, I still can't read that without tearing up. Mm-hmm. And I read it when I was working on this, you know, to when I was preparing for this to refresh my memory. But I thought, my goodness, these people, all of whom are very busy, and all of whom are among the people whose opinion of me I value the most, were willing to take time out from their busy schedules and make the effort to write down, you know, all of these nice comments about their experiences working with me and submit them. So, you know, I was blown away. I'm still blown away when I think about it. So, yes, I was very honored and gratified. Mm-hmm. The reception itself, now, as I mentioned before, I'm not someone who's comfortable being the center of attention. So from that perspective, I kind of felt, I don't know, I was a little nervous about it and about standing up and giving a speech. But at the same time, I was gratified. It was a lovely event. Mm-hmm. Good food. And I was very gratified at who showed up at the ceremony to congratulate me and wish me well. And I also really enjoyed meeting and hearing from and about the other winners, mm-hmm. For the other awards. I thought that part was very interesting to me.
So I want to end it there, but I always want to give the person I'm interviewing space. If there's anything on your mind, particularly from the questions that I've asked, that we want to make sure we get on this recording in case we don't think about it the next time.
I don't think so, although, quite honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if we come back the second time and like, oh, I was in the shower and I thought of something I should have said.
Well, to put on the record, if that happens, write it down or send me an email so we
Okay.
We know we need to get to
right.
it, because sometimes,
okay.
you know, we think of something,
yes.
but if we don't write it down,
yes.
we don't think
and
about
I'm
it again.
And I'm very guilty of that, yes.
So that concludes this first interview with Jean Hendricks. Jean, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Yep, and you can email.
All right, today is March 20th, 2017. This is a follow-up interview with, Jean Hendricks. Is it Jean?
Yes.
Okay. I always have trouble with that, whether
yeah,
it's Jean or
spelling,
Jean.
Yes.
We did the first interview on March 1st as part of the Academic Staff Institute. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So, Jean, to help me with sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Okay. Jean Hendricks. H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S.
Excellent. So, Jean, I'm going to get this just a little closer to you.
Okay.
You can talk at your normal level, and then
okay.
I'll just need to project to make sure
oh.
my questions get in.
Get on there.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, we had a couple of leftovers or things you wanted to add to before we got to the remaining questions on our list. So the first question was I asked a question about technology, mm-hmm. and then upon reflection, you felt like you had some stuff to add to that. So
yeah.
let's start with the technology
yeah,
question.
Yeah, I think last time I said that it requires the using the technology and implementing HR activities with the technology requires more of a less just routine entry and more of knowledge and wisdom-based entry. Mm-hmm. And I think basically as the technology has come into play over the years and it's gotten better and more user-friendly, and meanwhile we've gone through several different HR systems and structures that are attached to the technology at the time, that more of the work has been delegated down. And, you know, you can say from the state government to UW system to Madison campus and to the schools and colleges. And to use that technology appropriately, I need to have an understanding, or someone needs to have an understanding and appreciation of the implications of whatever we enter in the system. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the things that used to be results of conversations are now, you know, maybe some emailing back and forth, some putting some notes in the system. They're records now. So we have to be very, very careful of what we enter and why we enter it and what the implications are of what we're entering. For example, you know, there's a position description. Somebody needs a position, and they need to recruit for it. And, you know, it starts with entering a position description, which requires that you pick the appropriate employee category, the appropriate title, and that you enter the duties in a way that is as strong as it needs to be to convey an understanding of what the qualifications and the duties will be. And without, you know, there's always a temptation to kind of fluff, put some fluff into it and kind of overstate. And that, you know, you obviously want to do the best you can for the manager that you're working with, but you don't want to misrepresent, because that is a disservice to the manager, the campus, and the potential employee. If they think they're going to be doing things and then they get there and they're not. So I've always strived to be fair to everyone in everything I do, and this is, again, another example of how it's important to be accurate, complete, and fair. Because anything that's in there is potentially precedent-setting, and others will see it, and, you know, we get a lot of the, hey, you know, I do the same thing, and I'm not paid as well, and da-da-da, and that may or may not be true. And so I also want to ensure that I, representing the college, had a good, solid, trusting relationship with the people that we're answerable to at the campus level and beyond. So I hope that maybe clarifies a little bit what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
So then a question I wanted to ask based on the research and the conversation we had was about editing.
Okay.
So how do you feel? People have said that you were adept at being able to take ideas and, mm-hmm. and edit them and make them clearer. So mm-hmm. how do you feel okay. you were able to do that?
Well, that's my first reaction. I don't know. But I think it's a combination of my particular education, the training I have had over the years in my school years in language, writing, and I read a lot. I enjoy reading, so I think that helps. And then a lot of practice, doing it over and over again. I wrote stuff for grades in high school and college, and always did very well and grade wise. And then through the course of my job, I've learned more how to understand what the intent is of something that someone wants to communicate, and how can I, is that clear in what I see on the paper? And if not, are there changes I can make to make it even more clear to someone who would be reading it? For example, a policy and procedure document. I'm very tuned in on words, the importance of words, and the importance of the meaning of words and how they're interpreted. And so, with that viewpoint is how I approach editing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you just mentioned policies and procedures document. Mm-hmm. So we're now moving to the questions that were on the list from last time. And the first one is, why become involved in academic staff, personnel, policies, and procedure committee?
I think it was a very logical thing to do for someone who's an HR professional like I am. I mean, the main job of the PPPC is rewriting, updating, editing, as you would, the academy staff policies and procedures, which are the policies that apply to academy staff. And so, I had the perspective of a practitioner, and I also had the perspective of an academy staff member and someone who'd been around for a while. And so, and I think that it was a good fit because, it was a win-win that I could contribute to the document, and then on the other token, I, as a practitioner, I would have more solid understanding of what those policies and procedures are when it came time to implement them in specific cases.
Okay. So I think you just said that, but I want to ask directly, just in case you have more you want to elaborate on. So what does that committee do?
Okay. That committee, I think technically it says it provides advice and or, you know, about to all policies and procedures which affect academic staff. And the main activity of the committee is this document, Academic Staff Policies and Procedures. And we review it, we go through it chapter by chapter, and read the current version and decide whether, based on just another look at it or some things that have happened, cases that have come up since the last time, whether there's ways that some things that should, that are confusing, that should be reworded, or some things that are no longer relevant should be taken out, and, you know, things like that. We also take a look at things like, there's a report of ACME staff, what they call job security, that the principle is that ACME staff who've been, you know, high performers for a number of years should get a little bit more increased job security than when they started, and to make sure that people are reviewed at certain points in time and according to that policy, and noting if there were any situations where someone who, based on number of years, was eligible but they weren't given it, and the unit did not provide an understandable justification for not granting it. So those kind of situations we would look at. So those are the main activities of that committee.
You were on that committee for a significant significant amount of time.
Yeah.
So why stay involved in a committee like that as long as you did?
The two-way value of it continued right up until when I left. I mean, you know, the benefit to the activity and the benefit of the activity to my position, my job.
And you said, just one more follow-up about this. You may not have said this, but I sort of inferred from what you were saying, is that this document was, you know, what they call now a living document.
Yes, it is a living document. As far as I know, it still is a living document.
So were there major iterations of it, or was it always just constantly being updated, revised?
At the point when I entered the process, it was the revision. I think there was a major overhaul, but that happened a few years before I came on board.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about, well, maybe I'll ask this way. I mean, you were on the committee that long. I wonder if there were people that were on the committee with you that stood out for whatever reason why a person would stand out.
Well, Ann Wallace, for example. She was the chair of the committee for a number of years when I was on the committee. I think she was when I joined the committee, although that was a while ago. But, yeah, and Bruno Browning. He was on the committee for a number of years. He joined later on, but, and, you know, I remember it really isn't fair to pick out certain people because, you know, everybody on the committee, that we worked very well together as a group. We always seemed to find, you know, the new people that came on board always seemed to click with us. And I think there was only, we were very proud of the fact that there was only one time we actually had to vote on something that was a proposed change, that we usually were able to talk back and forth and reach a mutual agreement on whatever was being proposed.
So how often would the committee meet?
When I left, the last few years, I think it was like every 6 weeks. We could meet. There's always the option of meeting more often if there was something that was burning that needed to be addressed in more time than that would allow.
And how long was each meeting?
An hour and a half, I think.
And did you meet around campus, or was it?
Yeah, it was around campus. Okay. It's whoever could snag a meeting place that we could all get to. Mm-hmm. I think we might have met in this building one time. I know I've been in this building for a meeting. I don't remember for sure if that was that, but mm-hmm. when I came in here, I thought, oh, I know, this is kind of familiar.
And then what would be the process of reporting changes that were made to the document to academic staff?
That we would decide, you know, at what point we had enough of a body of changes or proposals or whatever to
make it worth their consideration, and then we would propose those. Those would go to the ASAC, the Acting Staff Executive Committee, and they would put it on the agenda, and then it would have two readings. The first reading was just to acquaint people with what we were proposing and let them ask questions, and then it was after that, the next time would be the vote.
Jean, is there anything else you want to say about that committee before we move on to a couple other things?
Well, I guess we always needed to balance the interests of the academy staff with the campus, with knowing that anything that was approved at the assembly, any changes would need to be approved at the campus and the system, and technically the Board of Regents, depends for some changes. So we had to always kind of maintain that balance.
I know you mentioned that there was only one time where there was actually a vote, but I wonder if there were ever other substantial enough changes that they stand out in your mind.
Well, I mean, there were there was some language in it at one point that was a footnote that had to do with property interests, you know, that ACME staff jobs represent a property interest, and that was not popular politically with state and et cetera. So there were attorneys involved in that discussion, and then ultimately the decision based on current case history, I guess you could say, said they thought we should take it out because it didn't really give us anything. Mm-hmm. And so that was the vote on that. And one has to be practical. You know, if something's in there, even if we understand why we have something in there, if it doesn't do any good, you know, what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for all of that about the committee. I appreciate that. So we're moving down now to the next one on the list. And the question is, sort of a vague one, but just in general, did you think about, as you worked, the relationship between faculty and staff?
Always.
Okay.
Especially later in my career when I became the go-to person in the college dean's office for any faculty personnel issues. And even before that, working with faculty members as managers and supervisors. That I noticed myself that the more I worked with them and interacted with them, the better was my understanding and appreciation of the unique challenges that they face. There are so much expected of them. Teaching, research, outreach, and occasionally administration, and there's never enough time. And I think that a lot of times that they were not understood, and therefore people made judgments about what the life of a faculty member was like, and unfair judgments. And, you know, the stereotype is that they're arrogant and don't want to teach and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we have, that college engineering has anywhere from 180 to 200 faculty members, and I interacted with a lot of them over the course of the years. And the number of faculty members I worked with who fit that stereotype, I could count on one hand easily. Most of the vast majority of them, I liked them, respected them, they were good to work with, and, you know, one of them even wrote one of my nomination supporting documents. And so, you know, I always got along fine with faculty. I think you could make the same, you could have the same discussion about other employee types. What used to be called classified, now university student workers, postdocs, you know, you name it. I think for each of those, there's not enough understanding of their position and their responsibilities, and there's a lot of generalizations that are unfair. Each appointment type, as you would, has an important role in this university. And I think anyone who looks at it that way would assert very strongly that we need all of them. We need each and all employee types to make this place run. Each has a role. Mm-hmm. So.
So maybe a little bit more about that, maybe just to talk a little bit about your job. And we did this a little bit at the first, but so the last job you had, who would you report to?
Okay, last job I had. It's not like I had, okay, basically I had two jobs. One, the payroll person to do payroll and benefits, and then the HR person who sometimes supervises those payroll and benefits operations. Mm-hmm. And that job sort of morphed in many different directions over the years. And so it's not like I applied for this job and this job and this job. It just was the same job that evolved over time. And the last person I reported, I always reported to either the dean or an associate dean or an assistant dean, depending on the administrative structure of the college at any point in time.
So you were here for a significant amount of time. How many then, either deans or associate deans, in terms of actual people that you ended up?
Okay, well, I think I went through four deans, you know, and that's not a, they didn't directly supervise me, but that's how many deans passed through the College of Engineering during the time I was there. And I think direct reports, probably four or five associate and or assistant deans.
Now, were all of them also faculty, or were
no.
they? So that's another layer of the relationship on this campus.
Yes,
complex
the
relationship.
Non-faculty administrators. Right. Yes, definitely. And that's interesting too. That when I started, the philosophy was that you had to be a faculty member to be a dean or an associate dean, and for some issues, that's true. It helps. Instructional, yes. Research, yes. But the administrative, which is the one I always worked under, you didn't really need to be a faculty member to supervise accounting and payroll and financial and HR and that stuff. And eventually they figured that out and then went to non-faculty leadership.
But that was a change during your time.
Yes.
So some of your deans were faculty.
Yes.
But by the end, it sounds like they were.
Yeah, some of the ones I reported directly to, they were not faculty.
Okay. So then to look at the sort of who reported to you, what types of people would report to you?
It was either HR managers, other HR managers in the dean's office, and or sometimes payroll and benefits staff.
Now, would those people be academic staff, university staff?
The payroll and benefits ones were, well, they were university staff. Let's see, I'm not sure if that's transferred. I think they still would be, but the and the HR managers were used to be classified staff. Their positions are ACME staff now, but the people in them don't have to switch. You know, when that change occurred, the people who were currently classified staff, who were HR managers, could stay classified if they wanted to. And if you had been there very long, you probably would choose to stay because you reach a point after a certain number of years when you get more vacation and sick leave as a classified. Mm. So.
Okay. Just writing something down here.
Yeah.
Is there anything more you want to say about the relationship between faculty and staff or some of these other relationships that you, you know, gladly, thank you, acknowledged existed too?
Well, you know, I also want to acknowledge student hourlies. They provided a lot of the very basic routine work that freed up our time to do other things. Like, you know, there was a scanning project, for example, that HR records were scanned into a computerized system, and the people who actually did the scanning, you know, put the paperwork on there and uploaded, were student hourlies, and that's very time consuming. And so I'm, you know, we were all very grateful to have very capable student hourly staff who could do that for us.
So what type, and by type I mean major, would be a student hourly for you?
Didn't matter.
Okay. So it wasn't, it could be engineering majors, but it didn't necessarily end up
right, right. Majors. And more often than not, they weren't. They were, you know, we recruited campus wide for any, you know, we
so just any wanted open position some, you just posted on the student.
There's a student job. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Student job center site. Yeah.
And then did you directly supervise student hourlies, or were there?
No. For example, the scanning project, one of the other HR managers in the dean's office, who I at one point supervised for a while, was in charge of that project, and she hired and supervised the student hourly who helped with that project. Mm-hmm. So it's like the specific little group that needed the student hourly for something mm-hmm. would be the one who supervised them.
How did you, I'll ask a self-assessment question here. How would you describe yourself as a supervisor?
Oh, boy. Well, I think I approached that, first of all, that was not my favorite thing to do. I don't really like being supervisor of other people. I'd rather work as an equal with anyone I work with and work collaboratively, and that's kind of really how I function. That was my supervisory style, was not top down at all. It was more like we're all on the same team. Let's work together on whatever we're trying to accomplish. And I found the evaluations very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. But I'm not alone there, I know. So,
did you try to take advantage of anything that campus provided in terms of things that, you know, Office of Human Resources
yes.
might provide to
yes.
make you?
Yes, okay. Office. Well, it was then called Office of Human Resource Development. I don't know if they still are or not. But, yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you for all of that. So we're going to move on to a specific event that happened, you know, globally, but its effect here for you and then also for your work, and that's September 11th, 2001.
Yes. That is one of those things I remember very clearly, exactly where I was and what I was doing and what happened when we first heard about this. I was at work in my office, and one of the administrative support staff whose desk was directly outside my office saw something on the news about it, and I think something online that popped up, and she's like, oh my gosh, guys, you know, she told us essentially what was going on, and we couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. It seemed very surreal. And then some of us decided, we have on the first floor directly below where my office was, we have a couple of auditoria that are used for large classes, and our media staff hooked up a live feed of CNN on one of the big screens, and some of us went down and we just watched in continued disbelief of what was going on. So yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember what, if anything, either, you know, for the College of Engineering or for campus in general, that happened as a result of 9/11?
Well, I think that for the campus in general, that it was traumatic in terms of making people feel insecure and unsafe. And I know that the campus employee assistance office worked with the campus as a whole and units as needed or as wanted to help people deal with this never-ending flood of information that was coming out if you, you know, tuned in, and replay after replay after replay of when the planes hit, And, you know, how do you put this in perspective and go on with your life? So I think that was the main impact that it had at the time.
Did you have anybody you knew or even secondhand who was at any of the
there?
Places where
no.
the...
Nope.
All right. Anything else you want to say about that?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have the final two questions, and the final question is sort of two parts, but the first final question is why retire when you did?
It seemed like the right time to do it. I think, you know, I had hit 66 and was able to start drawing Social Security. My situation with regard to the state retirement pension was good, and I was ready for so that I was going to be okay financially, you know, by doing it. And I think I was ready for a change. I was ready for a more relaxed pace, less stress, and more time and energy to spend with my family, my daughters and son-in-law and grandsons, to just help them with whatever they were dealing with.
Mm-hmm. So this is March of 2017. How long have you been retired?
March, I think that was when I went off the payroll. I actually, my last day at work was the last day of October 2016.
Okay.
So I've been away from work for almost a year and a half now.
Okay. Anything you miss about it?
The people. That's it. I don't miss the work.
What's some of the things you like about being retired?
Being retired? Oh, being able to just get up when I want to in the morning. And, you know, I'm an early riser anyway, so it's not like I'm sleeping way later than I did. But just getting up and not having that pressure to kind of get ready and get to work. And, oh, what am I going to be dealing with today? And all of that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I typically... I can watch some of the news in the morning and, you know, take a little bit longer to have breakfast and coffee and whatnot. And then I usually then go to the gym and work out about mid-morning, like 9 o'clock or so. Where I live, there's a gym right upstairs in the building. So I don't even have to leave the building to get there. So that's
nice.
Very nice. Yes. Yes. So.
And it sounds like maybe some increased family time too.
Yeah. You know, and that's the other thing. If something happens and one of my grandsons is suddenly sick and can't go to school that day, and for whatever reason, mom or dad, it would be very difficult for mom and or dad to stay home that day at impromptu like that. You know, I can, mm-hmm. you know, I'm there.
That's great. So the last question is sort of two parts. So it's the legacy question. So I'm going to ask it one question at a time. So what do you feel you'll be remembered for?
Okay. Well, lucky for me, because I got this award, I already know mm-hmm. some of the things, which actually makes it easier for me because, you know, I'm just not the kind of person that can say, oh, I'm so great, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That just isn't me. And I'm gratified to see that, you know, after looking at that, some of the things that people wrote, I thought, well, that's really very generous of them to write that. And actually, I'm gratified that that's how they remember me and how they view me. Primarily, I want to be a contributor to people. I want to add value, you know, to their lives. I want to be helpful. I want anyone who comes in contact with me for any reason to come away from that contact feeling that they're better off for the time that they spent. I want to be seen as being a fair person, respectful of others, and trustworthy. And level-headed, someone with good judgment, and a good sense of humor that I use when appropriate.
mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's kind of what I would like to be viewed.
Mm-hmm. And I guess since you got the award, you sort of know Well, you just said what you sort of want to be remembered for, and since you got the award, you kind of know what people do remember
you for. Right, right. And it, you know, it kind of worked either way, because in reading what people said about me, that kind of clarified for me, yes, those are the kind of things that I want to be remembered for. And, you know, and I run into people, like, on my way over here, I ran into somebody that works in engineering. Oh, hi! So that's kind of nice, run into people, and they seem, and there's a smile when they see you.
Right. No, that's great. Jean, is there anything else you want to say?
I don't think so. I think we've covered everything on the list.
Okay. Well, this concludes the follow-up interview with Jean Hendricks. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.